Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 18th of May, episode 4, and the long reach of race science. So, I don't think this is, there's all these pictures of these people, and hazard to guess that they are the same. No, they are different people, of course. Okay, so this article is, studying human variation is possible without resorting to race, argues Angela Sartini in this extract from her new book, The Long Reach of Race Science. In the end of the Second World War was the meant to have spelt the death of race science. Until the 1930s, it had been relatively acceptable for biologists and anthropologists to believe in innate differences between races. Many assumed that certain groups were superior to others. It was only after the war and the Holocaust that the world finally turned its back on the dangerous field of research. People thought about race differently following the war. Anthropologists say that most of what we think is racial difference is in fact cultural and linguistics. Geneticists started with Richard Leonworth in 1972, have shown that more than 90% of genetic variation we see between humans lies within the racial categories we use. Being of the same race doesn't necessarily make two people more genetically similar to each other than either of them would be to someone of another race. Race is today described as a social construct. It's study confined to social sciences so we can understand the effects of historical and modern-day discrimination. The handful of scientists who have continued to insist publicly on the existence of biological races have often been on the margins of respectability. There was William Schottky, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist at Stanford University in California, who wanted black women in the US to be voluntarily sterilized. And then there was Arthur Jensen, the psychologist of the University of California, Berkeley, who claimed black people had innately lower intelligence levels than white people. We think of Jensen and Schottky as exceptions. We assume race has been purged from science, but has it? In truth, it's never completely disappeared. There remains a suspicion among some scientists that there could be something tangible in race, that genetics will be someday uncover the unpalatable truth. Last year's Harvard population geneticist David Reich wrote in the New York Times, "It's simply no longer possible to ignore the average genetic differences among races." Reich told me in an interview a month later that he doesn't believe these distances will be large and genetics will continue to shatter racial myths. Even so, there are differences amongst people. We don't know what they are, so we have to deal with the uncertainty. This uncertainty reflects how even well-intentioned, politically neutral researchers such as Wright can't help but resort to race when thinking about human difference. The field of population genetics is a case in point. One of the former leading lights, the late Luigi Lucia Cavalli-Scorfa, was a staunch anti-racist. In 1973, he publicly debated race with Schottky in Stanford, where he was also a professor. Yet, even Cavalli-Scorfa, whose work focused on understanding how genetic variation is distributed amongst humans, clung to the belief that race isn't a completely redundant concept in genetics. In his book Genes, People and Languages, published in 2000, Calvi Selva wrote, quote, "A race is a group of individuals that we can recognize as biologically different from others." He was a statistical definition of race. His was a statistical definition of race based on the concept that there are clusters of people who share certain gene frequencies. So while our common racial categories may have little meaning, suggested Cavalli, certain populations, especially tight-knit ones, could be considered races even if only statistically. There was no distinct racial types with hard boundaries, only statistical similarities between whichever groups you wanted to identify. Philosopher Lisa Garnett at St. Mary's University in Halifax, Canada, has warned of ethical repercussions of thinking about race in this clustered way. The problem lies in the need to group in the first place, to separate people, even when that means having to zoom in on the tiny bits of the genome that might differ. Even then, those tiny differences are only on average not applicable to every person in that group. Garnett calls it statistical racism. While scientists may feel that they have left race behind, she argues, in reality, it's only their language and parameters that have changed. They may not call them the races, but researchers today still refer to European and African populations. Population trap. This clustered way of thinking about race culminated in the 1990s with the Human Genome Diversity Project, spearheaded by Kavina Salvosky himself. He and his colleagues, based mainly in the US, wanted to take DNA samples from what they saw was distinct, isolated indigenous people around the world, including Basques of Europe, Kurds in Turkey, Native Americans, and use them to build a picture of the past as well as human evolutionary change. It seems quite logical to me. This new perspective, they announced in the Journal of Genomics in 1991, would supplement the strengthening findings of archaeology, linguistics, and history. Could this be called race science? Those behind the Human Genome Diversity Project didn't see what they were doing as race science, but it's hard not to see how the project bore some of its hallmarks. Weird to me. One scientist, for example, quote, talked about the need to sample isolates of historical interest in terms of indigenous populations did not care for. Says a term that indigenous populations did not care for. Says Henry Glealy at the Stanford Law School, who was brought in to navigate the ethical issues around the project. It struck me that it was not likely to be well received because it's a very clinical, bloodless way of referring to people who are alive, the cultures, and are living now. Historical interest is something you find in a museum. It was tone deaf. Politically anti-racist, though the scientists behind the projects were, they felt fell into the trap of treating some populations as biologically special and distinct. They forced people into categories that did not necessarily make... Well, she was... just working my way through here. Evolutionary sense, in the same way race scientists did in the 18th and 19th century when coming up with racial categories we use today. These populations were sometimes defined by little more than a culture or linguistic boundaries. The idea that people in these groups are somehow truly genetically similar is a huge assumption, says sociologist Catherine Bliss at the University of California, San Francisco. Just because communities appear to be tight-knit and ancient doesn't mean that they've never been mixing between them and others. There has always been a mixing between all human populations, which is why we're so similar today. Even at the outset of the Human Genome Diversity Project, concerns were raised before it was launched and an alternative was mooted. Rather than sampling the DNA of population groups thought to be isolated, scientists could instead study people at regularly spaced geographic intervals throughout the globe. This grid sampling approach was championed by Alan Wilson, a biochemist based at the University of California, Berkeley, known as the mitochondrial Eve hypothesis, placing our most recent common ancestor in Africa around 200,000 years ago. Wilson believed that the grid sampling would document human variation as it really was rather than imposing possibly incorrect assumptions on existing groups. Quote, if you were to grid sample, says Bliss, you're not going to get tiny and neat similarities. This is because there aren't any. Human variation does not sit along precise boundaries. It is messier than any racial model, which is neighbouring populations blending into the next. While some populations might have slightly different gene frequencies to others, there is no gene that appears in all members of one race and not in another. Wilson's approach would have been got closer to the actual similarities, says Bliss. It would have been more accurate. But Wilson died aged 56 just before the first planning meeting of the Human Genome Project began. Without him, his grid for a sampling proposal was shelved. The project went on to become mired in ethical controversy and protests from indigenous groups. It never secured funding it needed to get off the ground. For geneticist Mark Jobling of the University of Leicester, UK, the way the project was structured, deliberately targeting particular populations rather than looking for the DNA of people wherever they happened to be in the world, was ultimately undermined. How do you define a population in the first place? These are culturally loaded things in themselves, he says. So there was a lot of cultural discrimination in the original aims. It's perfectly possible a study of global human variation without grouping people, says Joblin. Our genomes have so much in common. The physical variations are so subtle, the humans can be theoretically be grouped together anywhere we like. The genetic variations associated with light skin, for instance, are not common to only Europeans and parts of East Asia, but also in, say, hunter-gatherers in southern Africans. You could do a thought experiment where you grouped everyone on Earth based on three nationalities, Kenyan, Swede, and Japanese, he says. Theoretically, everyone would be placed in one of these groups, as we are all genetically connected on average to Kenyan, Swedes, and Japanese persons, either directly or by historical migration. And you could say that you were 70% Kenyan, 70% Swedish, and 70% Japanese. This may seem bizarre, and of course he's not suggesting we do it, but it is no more bizarre than dividing the world into black, brown, and yellow, red, white race, as race scientists once did. It is only a little less arbitrary than racial categories we use today. Medical researchers have noticed how poor proxy for human variation these racial categories can be. Even the gene that causes sickle cell, which is people often think has been mainly associated with those of African ancestry, is actually found in all ethnic groups, as the UK's National Institute of Health and Care Excellence points out. This isn't to say that those behind the projects were racist. Racism is born out of ignorance, fear and of the strange, and a desire to power. It is also to be fought, firstly, by showing its nonsense and its real roots, Cavelli Soa wrote in an email interview with me 6 months before he died in August 2018. He was a force for good, a scientist who fought publicly against racism and fascism in the full understanding of what this meant, having lived in Italy during the Second World War. Yet, in the same exchange, she also referred to children of partners coming from genetically distant groups, commonly known as mixed race or mixed heritage children, as hybrids, a term many might not see to be both morally and scientifically appropriate. Now, Cavari was an old-school anthropologist, says Jobling. He would show old slides of him collecting DNA blood samples in Africa from pygmy groups and offering glass beads and cigarettes in return. Yes, hun? T-A-R-A-G-O. Yeah, I'll have to take it to get the quote. It may be impossible to expect everyone, especially biologists born in 1922, to completely shed ideas of race and prevalent in the early 20th century, particularly when society in general still lives with them today. Racial discrimination is still widespread in education and employment, for example. This is the heart of the problem. It is difficult to be convinced that the mainstream scientists fully abandoned race science after the Second World War, not because they were racist, but because they were human. They were living in a world that was still ridden with racism, segregation, and apartheid. The old ideas of race had been a firm part of everyday science, wouldn't simply vanish. What happens is that you've got a large community of well-meaning, self-described anti-racist scientists seeking to find a way to move beyond the race into population genetics, which seems to be incredibly neutral. It's a numbers, statistical and subjective, says historian Jonathan Richard of Yale University. But, quote, population genetics is a science done by people working on assumptions and ideas that are available at the time. Race is useless. According to geneticist Mark Thomas at University College London, who has collaborated with Rex, race is a useless way to think about human variation. Quote, there is no categorical imperative in biology and no need to value in placing people in biological boxes, he says. Unfortunately, that doesn't stop people radicalizing others and perhaps reflects the desire to categorize. The recent discovery that other, now extinct humans, such as Neanderthals and Denisovans, bred with Homo sapiens, has reignited the racial debate, prompting some to wonder if a greater proportion of the ancestral DNA shared by Europeans, for instance, gives a meaning to our racial categories. But as anthropologists John Shear and Stony Brook University New York notes, quote, interbreeding thing is more like a symbolic thing for us than it is for the evolutionary consequence. Even now, scientists struggle to accept that they may still be working within the framework of the past. There remains a tendency to treat population groups as if they are genetically distinct. The Center for Study of Human Polymorphisms in Paris, France, keeps a bank of DNA samples from populations all over the world. And in 2015, the University of Oxford launched a project to make a genetic map of people within the UK named People of the British Isles. While no members of the project would see themselves as race scientists, it could be argued that grouping people harks back to the same methods. Population genetics also fuels the trend for consumers' ancestry testing. In 2016, Ancestry DNA announced that it had sold around 100 million kits. The Human Genome Diversity Project had these ethnic groupings, and all these ancestry testing firms have either ethnic groupings, which are the same groupings. They collect DNA and have reference populations, and they're interchangeable. The way they communicate those results and the map of people's ancestry is a completely ethno-racialized way. Among the public, the test may reinforce a belief that race has a deeper biological meaning. In 2017, it was reported that the white supremacists in the US were using them to prove how white they were, banishing their results as proof of shared European ancestry. These tests are based on the belief that there is a distinct Asian population from which each of us hail, says Bliss. The answer, perhaps, is for researchers to stop thinking about people in clusters. One of the most pernicious assumptions that we still hold when it comes to human genetics and genomics is that specific races have specific genes for specific genetic material that are unique to them. Or what about I don't think you have that genetic mutation occurring randomly. And what about lactose intolerance, just for some? The assumption is false, but we are never free from fallacy, she says. Quote, if we keep on sampling by racial categories or ethnologist categories and write data through the software, then we slap the categories back on afterwards. So that's one story, and 17 minutes in reading that one story about race and sampling. It didn't really say all that much to me, unfortunately. Features. A world without riot. Search stuff is essential for modern life, but the world supply is worryingly vulnerable. A solution is urgently needed. In a classic episode of The Simpsons, Bart and his schoolmates watch an educational film, A World Without Zinc. For reasons I'll explain, the man called Jimmy wants to live a life without zinc. His wish is granted, but he soon regrets that he can't go to it on a date because his car won't start. He can't call his girlfriend because his telephone won't work. Horrified at what he's done, he tries to shoot himself, but his gun won't fire because the firing pin is made of zinc. In real life, a world without zinc would probably be survivable, but there are some commodities which we struggle with. Many are obvious, steel, oil, aluminium, but others less so. A world without zinc, Jimmy wakes up to find that it's all a bad dream. In a world without rubber, however, the nightmare threatens to become ultra-real. Rubber is historical, is one of the industrial civilization's great unsung heroes, in part from its obvious uses in tires, wellies, condoms, underwear, elastic. It's a crucial ingredient of some 40,000 products, including shock absorbers, emission belts, gaskets, hoses, metal devices, sports equipment, cements, paints, plastics, pharmaceuticals. According to agricultural scientist R.P. Pabrikanair, rubber is, quote, essential to the enjoyment of conveniences and amenities of modern life. Unfortunately, the prospect of rubber crisis isn't the stuff of fiction. Demand keeps growing, but supply isn't keeping pace. With a deadly fungus threatening to wipe out the rubber trees and rubber industry, the hunt is on for a new source of stuff. Right now, the world has two of those sources, oil and trees. For many applications, the tree version, called natural rubber, is considered superior than the synthetic version made from petrochemicals. It's stronger, more elastic, better absorbing impacts, and more resilient to heat friction. In other words, rubbery. To connoisseurs, the differences lie between Madagascar vanilla and synthetic substitute. The key to good rubbers is the very long polymer molecule, some probably called spontaneous self-reinforcement, reversible stiffening under mechanical stress. Think of a car cornering. The tire deforms a bit, which causes it to stiffen in response. That enables the natural rubber to be either elastic or hard as it is a process mediated by proteins and fats at the end of long polymer chains and molecules. These have proven hard to create in a synthetic form. For some applications, everything from engine parts to silicone cooking utensils, synthetic rubber or blend of synthetic and natural is superior. But for many, natural rubber is indispensable. For instance, aircraft tyres must be 100% natural rubber, or the heat and friction would make them explode on landing, says Katrina Collins, rubber expert of Arrowhead State University. For the past 70 years or so, the world's major source of natural rubber has been para rubber tree, a native of Brazil, and it's now grown all over the tropics. It's tapped for latex, a white gunk oozes out of the tree bark, has partially been carefully sliced. This process to make rubber has been known. The total area under cultivation is 100,000 square kilometres, mostly in Southeast Asia. The para produces excellent rubber, but grows slowly and extremely fussy about temperature, rainfall and altitude, which restricts the range in just a few degrees north and south of the equator. Extracting the latex is labour-intensive, and scaling up production is almost impossible, meaning the rubber is extremely and erotically inelastic. Recycling is notoriously difficult too, see Reclaim Rubber, page 46. In 2017, the global demand for rubber was close to 30 million tonnes. The natural rubber industry could only satisfy about 45% of that. The proportion will only diminish. Up until the recession of 2008, the price of natural rubber went up about tenfold over a decade because of expanding economies of Asia, said David Wallen, the plant breeder and geneticist at the University of Guelph in Canada. The recession tempted that increase, but people were still very concerned about future supply. But as the countries of Southeast Asia developed economically, landowners are shifting away from rubber. They cut down their rubber trees and plant oil palm instead, which is less labour intensive and you get your harvest sooner. The shift from palm oil is a threat to supply, but it isn't the worst. A much bigger one is the lack of genetic diversity of the para tree crop, which makes it frighteningly susceptible to disease, especially the fungus called the South American leaf blight, the Black Death of rubber. So that would normally be a waterborne fungus. So it's interesting how that goes. So funguses are by spore, or the spores can have flagellum in them. And it's different from your symbiotic funguses, which have been with plants for a very long time. It killed off the American, the rubber industry in South America in the 1930s. As yet, it hasn't spread to Asia thanks to strict quarantine measures. But if it does, the world economy is in big trouble. If the blight ever got to Southeast Asia, it would break havoc on the rubber supplies, says Walton. The industry could be wiped out in a year. Because of this, leading our governors have warned that the supply of natural rubber is an international security issue. A sudden shortage in aircraft tyres, for example, could destabilise global trade. The threat is so great, the United Nations listed the leaf blight as a potential biological weapon. Of all of which has spurred decades-long global search for alternative searches for rubber. Dozens of plants have been tried, yet most have failed. The Panama rubber tree, Escala, for example, produces good rubber, but usually dies after being tapped, while India rubber plant Fisca Escalasica is hardy but produces poor quality rubber. Now, however, two unlikely candidates, a feeble northern weed and scrubby desert shrub, have put the spring back into rubber's industry step. It's rarely possible to pinpoint the exact time and place of a crop's domestication, but the para rubber tree is the exception. In 1876, where the Amazon and Chagres rivers meet at the Paris Dam, it was there a British explorer, Henry Wickham, collected some 70,000 H. brasinus seeds, which she took back to Kew Gardens in London on a falsified export. Well, there you go. License. Kew germinated the seeds and dispatched seedlings to parts of which is now Sri Lanka, Malaysia, Singapore and Indonesia, where they used to establish plantations. These quickly outcompeted the South American industry, which relied on smallholders tapping latex for more trees. Today, about 90% of all natural rubber comes from the descendants of Wiccan's contraband trees, mostly Indonesia and Malaysia. According to Nair, every tree in this nation is a clone of just one of the 1919 seedlings. Some of the largest rubber-producing countries have miles of virtually identical trees with their roots and canopies intermingled. That's a blight epidemic waiting to happen. The industry has tried to increase genetic diversity by crossbreeding with other strains, but none appears to be resilient to Black Death. It's only a matter of time before the fungus makes landfall in Asia and roots through the plantations. It's a small amount, two small outbreaks are rumored to have happened already. On both occasions, it took scorched policy to stop the spread. Yeah. How do you beat fungicides? I think it's copper sulfates fungicide. Okay. It'd be interesting that you think genetic engineering of bacteria would produce the funguses. Producer, like a fungus, could actually be used to produce rubber. Although the world as a whole has yet to endure a rubber famine, it's happened in some regions. One was the Soviet Union during the Second World War, then when Southeast Asian exports were blocked by the Japanese. Luckily, USSR had already sown seeds of a domestic rubber industry. In the early 1930s, Soviet agronomists tested more than 1,000 species of indigenous plants as sources of rubber. The rubberiest was the Zambian dandelion, a native of the Tan Shan Mountains in Kyrgyzstan. This close relative of the common garden or patio weed produces large amounts of high-quality rubber in its roots. Local people had long used it as a kind of chewing gum, and the second half of the scientific name, Taxan Khoisakha, means rubber root in Kazakhstan. Throughout the decade, the Soviets developed a way to cultivate and process the dandelion. Based on the Nazi invasion, but by the time of the Nazi invasion in 1991, the USSR had 67,000 hectares of it. And domestic rubber was meeting 30% of its needs. Production continued after the war, but was halted in 1951 as cheaper South African rubber bounced back into market. Japanese blockade also hit the US in 1942. It set up an emergency rubber project employing more than 1,000 subject scientists to find alternatives. They too experimented with the Siberian dandelions, also a desert shrub, Parthen agarum, better known as the Wai Uli. This had already been commercialized as a rubber crop in the early 20th century, although that industry died out in the Great Depression. The project cultivated wild Wai Uli plants from Mexico and Texas, but the war ended before it could make much headway. Now, however, this is an amazing thing, is that America went completely ape and built huge stockpiles of tires, and then when the Korean War set, all the tires just went, the tires just didn't keep. So a tire produced 10 years doesn't keep over 10 years because of just oxidation. However, both plants are back in the frame. They would go a long way to solving our problem. The dandelion sign, the German tire giant, Continental, has set up a research centre in Fraunhofer Institute of Molecular Biology and Applied Ecology in Munster. In the US competitor, Bridgestone runs a pilot plant in Arizona that makes grey rubber. Both firms recently unveiled demonstration tires, proving the alternative rubber is high enough quality, although neither is yet commercially available. Dandelion rubber is also being developed in China, India, US, with projects in Spain, Australia and South Africa. Team Dandelion recently stole a march on the competition when the team at Chinese Academy of Sciences published a K-Ball stock genome, a critical step towards rapid crop improvement. It helps tremendously to understand the genetic traits the breeders are after since the plant genesis. Kenneth Olson, Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. That allows you to have a more informed breeding strategy. And that's sort of, it's sort of like that. This is the evolution of science. It's sort of like you don't try perhaps cheap logical ways to, you don't try research. And the thing is that people only fund focused research, and the fact that the research finds a lot of different things. There are still hurdles to overcome, says Cornish, who has commercial interest in both plants. The Danelongs isn't strong plants, she says. It grows slowly to start with, and we don't have a chemical weed control. It's going to be a commercial, if it's not going to be a commercially viable crop until this is achieved. So it is a weed, and we can't get rid of it. There is also a challenge of scaling up to millions of hectares needed to meet demand, a problem for both contenders. Ultimately, the world needs all three crops, says Cornish. Demand for natural rubber is so high that nobody is going to put one of these out of business. We would have to be a rubber tree. We could have the rubber tree in the tropics, the dandelions in the northern temperate regions, the guanolin in the semi-arid areas. They complement each other, she says. For now, maybe we should show more appreciation for the essential stuff and hope we don't live to see a world without rubber. Not the world without zinc. What is a world without zinc? I don't think the scan is there. 31. And okay, so I'll just read the last word. The back page is feedback. Dog days. Feedback is displayed. Returning from our morning constitutional, we discovered the cause of the suspect pong that has been following us, in the form of a sizable patty of dog dirt attached to our shoe. Considering our immediate instinct to release the hounds in search of a culprit to be counterproductive, we turn to the forensic science. Poo Prince is a US company that offers DNA solution to dog waste. It promises to get the scent of dog owners who won't clean up after their pets by matching poo with pooch. There's a catch. All suspects need to be a doggy DNA database. This is mostly workable for pets, apartment housing complexes, where the management company can request all dogs on the property to be registered. The company suggests kicking off with a dog day to make swabbing fun in order to collect the necessary genetic data. Feedback is conflicted. Do we risk dog walking into surveillance state here? Sleepwalking. Not answered, for example, is just how long a dog's DNA will be kept on file when it hasn't been charged with a crime. Should privacy campaigners be in arms or legs, even demanding a due canine process? Don't say roll over. Do say who's a good boy until proven otherwise by a jury of his peers. I like that. It's beautiful. You really got it. Who's a good boy? He's a good boy. Now, reading some things. We have sent large number of spacecraft satellites into space. Oh, there's a bee having a good go at me. Now, I might find that the... What is happening? This must reduce the mass of the planet, albeit by a small amount. Does this reduction affect the Earth's gravity with respect to the Sun and the Moon? The Sun and the Moon. Bearing in mind that much of the stuff we send to space falls back down again, only a few hundred tons of spacecraft have actually escaped Earth's gravity since the first space programs began. Yep. Okay. This is tiny compared with the quantity of hydrogen or other gases that escape continuously space from the upper atmosphere. Now, this has been estimated between 30,000 and 65,000 tons per year. There's also the incoming of space thing. Earth also gains about 4,000 tons per year in the form of meteorites and space dust. Overall, the planet gets slightly lighter each year. But this only amounts to 1/1,000,000,000%. The Earth is still very, very heavy. Okay, so that's interesting. Though we have this fall down, most of it's out. And most of the launch rockets fall back to Earth, and the used fuel also stays in the atmosphere. And the small part of the rocket, actually the bit that makes the orbit, for example, the 2,800-ton Saturn V, still the most powerful rocket ever, was able to put 118 tons into orbit, just over 4% of its launch mass. Also, spacecraft in orbit are still a part of the Earth. They even geosynchronous orbit at an altitude of 37,000 kilometers. They contribute to the planet's gravity just as much as they did when they were standing on the launch pad. Well, that's a Newtonian viewpoint. Okay, as you approach, you'll be able to see if they're balanced. So the gravity is obviously going to be different. That's why you have gravity going out. The main point, though, is that all these figures are so small compared to the mass of the Earth itself, the effect is almost completely irrelevant in the planet's gravity. Rick Mendworth, Hevershire, Jim Barnett. Although the mass of the Earth itself decreases slightly when a satellite is sent into orbit, the total mass of the Earth and the satellite stays the same. Assuming satellites are distributed more or less evenly around the orbit, this also means that the position of the center of the mass of the Earth at the satellites doesn't change, so the Earth's gravity with respect to the Sun and the Moon isn't affected. Sending a spacecraft to another planet or beyond the solar system does reduce the mass of the Earth and the satellites, but this is probably too small to have any effect. Intimate contact. From a pathogenic perspective, which is more dangerous, being licked by an animal or kissed by a human? I was once told that germs don't fly, they hitch and hike. Many mammals can carry pathogens that are transmissible to humans, so I'm not at all keen at being licked by any animal. Dogs that work on our farm do hard-working infectious kelpies, are washed and wormed regularly, but they aren't allowed to lick me. I still can't get over the fact that they see animal remains as attractive, and they are possible carriers of tapeworms, which can cause serious illness. Sheep, cattle, and goats can be infected by bacteria and cause Q fever, and cats can be infected with Toxoplasma, which is a little worm which makes you aggressive. Both are transmissible to humans, although this means other than licking and kissing. As for humans, I am adverse to being kissed by strangers. My Italian heritage means that an informal hug and kiss greeting is expected from family and close friends, but even then, I just give a hug. I'm probably... who is this speaking here? Anna Butcher. I'm not about to find out whether being licked by an animal or kissed by a human is more dangerous. I'll keep my distance and keep washing my hands. It depends on the personal hygiene. Animals, of course, lick and eat items that have been exposed to a wide variety of pathogens. Humans are usually much more hygienic when it comes to these things. However, some of us are more strict in hygiene than others. The question is whether it is more dangerous to be licked by an animal or kissed by a human must be taken as a case-by-case basis. I love that. Getting ahead. My fringe seems to grow faster than the rest of my hair. This is just because I notice it more, or does the hair grow at different rates on different parts of the head? I've had a fringe for almost my life. It's very noticeable when it grows 10 millimetres. I've had to cut it. But I don't notice the rest of my hair so much, so I think the question of perception rather than different growth rates. Incidentally, my hair hasn't grown more slowly with age. I'm now 70. But each hair follicle dies after a shorter time, and I did when I was younger. The hair on my head, which was Westland, is now about 150 millimetres shorter than it was 10 years ago. Isn't that a lovely story? So that's the end of this. Thanks for listening. Some very interesting stories. Just go back over it so I can re-remember it. There was a bit about the dog days, about dog poo, this natural rubber. This is but it's part of myself going into it. Natural rubber, genetics, the genetics of race, and there was an article to start off with, which is, genetics. Thanks for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.